Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. We are taping this live and in person in beautiful downtown sunny San Diego, where Brother Mike and I hail from, as most of our good listeners are aware of, back in New York. I'm not sure what it's doing in Mike's area today. In Hamburg, it is snowing and in the 20s. Today in San Diego, sunny and in the 70s. What's not to like, Mike?
Not much to complain about there, Tom. Certainly glad to be here in sunny San Diego. This is the 10th edition of Firehouse World, with plenty of trucks and vendors and a good show so far. We've Tom and I have done three classes together and have had firefighters from Washington and Oregon and Colorado, Wyoming, and even Pennsylvania came all the way out here to San Diego to soak up the sun. So what's the rundown, Tom?
Okay, here's what we're going to be talking about this month. We're going to be talking about some recent accidents, and unfortunately Mike's going to be talking about a few very, very tragic line of duty deaths involving apparatus. We're going to talk about extensively how should our apparatus change due to limited staffing. As we've gone around the country, it's becoming evident that even beyond departments that are staffed entirely by volunteers, that the career departments are having to do more with less. So we're going to be talking about some strategies of things that we need to be thinking about to intelligently adapt our apparatus to meet the challenges of limited staffing. We're then also going to be talking about how to plan your fleet and apparatus replacement and how to justify those capital expenditures. Over the course of the last couple of months, we had kind of had hope that the economy would even partially turn around, and no matter what your pension is or your political views may be, it's pretty evident that we're in the middle, as far as the fire service goes, of having to increasingly justify our operating costs and any capital expenditures. So we're going to be talking about that, and if we have a little bit of time, we'll wrap up and talk about a couple of the rigs that are on display here for our listeners that are unable to make it out to the show. So, Mike, I know it's been really heart-wrenching here over the course of the last 10 to 14 days to read these incidents as they come in, but what do you want to fill us in on some of the most recent line-of-duty deaths?
Yeah, I guess, Tom, it just goes back to the old adage that if we don't learn from history, it's doomed to repeat itself over and over and over again. Within the past week or so, a firefighter in Gore, Virginia, was killed. And what makes this extraordinarily tragic is that his father was driving the truck in which he was killed on. And talk about preventability. From everything that we can understand, it was a house fire in neighboring West Virginia. The Ford Louisville tanker truck that they were on had dumped a load of water at the dump site at the house fire in West Virginia, right over the border. It's a department that's on the Virginia-West Virginia border. And as they were returning with a second load of water, the father hit a patch of ice, and his son, allegedly, from what we can gather, was on the rear step of this truck. When he hit the patch of ice, he went off the road and flipped the truck over. The father was slightly injured, and his son was killed in the line of duty. In the accident, he was declared dead, we believe, at that scene. Just an unbelievable tragedy. Tom and I, our heartfelt prayers and thoughts go out to the Gore Volunteer Fire Department in Virginia and all those affected, particularly his dad. We report this certainly with heavy hearts. And You know, we say over and over again that you needed to be seated and belted, and I think there are many in the fire service that believe riding on the outside of trucks is passe and that we've gotten beyond that. But if you believe that, then you're truly naive. Unfortunately, with all the education, with the NFFF, with, you know, Firehouse World, Firehouse Expo, with Firehouse Magazine, all the other periodicals, all the websites, all the education, all the seminars, talking about being seated and belted in an approved enclosed position, we have done a good job, but we still obviously have a ways to go. And just as we air here overnight, there was a line of duty death. An 18-year-old firefighter was killed riding in the officer's position on a custom cab apparatus. They were returning from a carbon monoxide detector. It was raining 8:30 last night. The driver, for whatever reason, lost control of the apparatus, ended up in a ditch, and they took out a utility pole on the upside of this, if there can ever be an upside to a line of duty death. The firefighter that was killed did have a seatbelt on. It appears from the pictures that we have seen that the utility pole, however, went right into the officer's side of the cab, and you know, there's just a few accidents like this that are accidents/incidents that even with a seatbelt on that unfortunately we're not going to be able to survive, unfortunately. And also our hearts and prayers go out to all those affected in that fire department in Illinois. So it just... And then we had a video submitted to the website of firefighters riding in the back of a raised roof cab on the way to a run on YouTube that showed them without seatbelts on. One firefighter was actually taking an SCBA out, standing up in the back of the truck as this apparatus was zipping along. And, you know, we can't urge people enough that you need to be seated and belted for every run. We're working very hard nationally on getting better seatbelts that are more accommodating to firefighters. We're trying to get better seating and more room to accommodate firefighters riding an apparatus. And we really need to continue to work hard, like organizations like DIAFC and the Fallen Firefighters Foundation have worked, trying to continue to heighten awareness on seatbelt use and responding safely to fires and other emergencies. Any other thing that we could tell our audience for sure is that this is 2012, and everything that we do in and around fire apparatus, we are in the public eye. We are a thrill to many, and everybody has a camera. And regardless of who you are or where you are, as long as you're in and around a piece of fire apparatus or in and around a fire station or in and around a fire scene, you are fodder for those that want to videotape us. And so you need to conduct yourself in the highest order of what the fire service expects of public deployment, to ensure that you don't end up on YouTube or your department in a compromising position and having the fire chief have to, you know, call to get videos taken down because we have misbehaved. So when you put that uniform on and when you ride on fire apparatus or ambulances and you represent your FDs, you need to conduct yourself in the highest tradition of the fire service and not become part of the problem, but try to become part of the solution.
Thanks, Mike. We're going to get back and now talk a little bit about how we should approach and look at different deployment strategies with our apparatus due to limited staffing. Whether your department operates as a career organization with you can count on the number of brothers and sisters that are going to be showing up to work every day, could be a combination department where you have basically a skeleton crew and relying upon volunteers or call personnel to supplement them when you have an incident, or in an all-volunteer organization. It's becoming more and more apparent that our staffing, when we say is limited, in some cases been limited due to political considerations because of financial constraints, and that was very, very evident by some of the folks that Mike and I spoke to out here at Firehouse World over the course of the last couple days, where we heard all kinds of stories, which are very unfortunate and potentially, hopefully, will not show themselves in a tragic situation, but where departments are operating their apparatus with certainly fewer than ideal personnel, and in some cases having to combine the resources on a traditional engine and a ladder company and running them out together basically as a two-piece company to try to have even somewhat reasonable staffing to be able to mitigate an incident once they get called. So I think one of the things that we need to think is but potentially beyond the obvious, Mike, is that no matter what our staffing levels are, the fire trucks themselves are not going to do anything until we get enough total personnel at the scene to be able to mitigate the incident. So if your department is going through a cost-cutting or slashing reduction where they are limiting the number of people of career staffing that are on each unit, we can't lose sight of the fact that it still takes a minimum of 15 to 18 personnel if you get any significant structural fire to be able to cover all the bases and to get all of the different tasks accomplished. We heard a lot of folks that came to the show that said, well, we were operating a traditional engine and truck, and now our chief is thinking of buying a Quint, and they're looking at that apparatus to be the magic bullet to solve the issue. But I know, Mike, you've had the good fortune of working in FDNY, where staffing levels are constant, they're consistent, they're contractually obligated, and while you have had some issues, it's not anywhere near as severe as some of the situations that we've heard. But your comments or thoughts on, you know, one thing is to say what's adequate staffing per unit, and if you don't have adequate staffing per unit, you need to get more of those units responding and putting more of those rigs on the street. So sometimes it might look like the lineup at the beginning of the Memorial Day parade, but we need to get the bodies there to effectively, you know, do the different tasks and evolutions that are going to be necessary to mitigate whatever we've been called to do.
Yeah, it's interesting, Tom, because when I teach, we ask the question in the ladder class, what puts fires out? And sometimes you'll get firefighters saying, well, water or the trucks, and both answers are completely false. Firefighters put fires out. You could have a hydrant full of water here and a pumper there, and if we don't have personnel to hook it up and stretch a hose line and go start fire suppression activities, then none of that's going to happen. And unfortunately, in this political climate where the fire service seems to be under a full frontal attack, the politicians and some of the city hall dwellers, as Chief Goldfeder refers to them, just quite frankly don't get it. We came up with, it was very arbitrary, and for a 2.5-story wood frame house fire, we came up with a minimum staffing of 20, and that included a RIT or a FAST team as well, and chiefs on EA and Seaside, and certainly not anything, and three hand lines, one for the fire floor, one for the floor above, and a backup line, and then a search team, and then a vent team, nothing extraordinary, and it added up to 20 people. And you look at those tasks that those 20 people are doing, and then if you have less than that, you have to find out, well, where are you going to get the rest of the 20 people? Or if you can't get 20 people, then you have to start deciding which tasks aren't going to get done. You're not going to have a RIT team, or you're not going to vent, or you're not going to search, or you're not going to have a backup line. and some really severe, almost sad choices that have to be made. And this is just for a fire in a 2.5-story wood frame. When we start talking large area commercial buildings, Rosa store, high-rise firefighting, and even large multiple dwellings, 20 is going to be woefully inadequate as well. And firefighters that try to operate in those occupancies with fewer than 20, it's almost like what I refer to as kamikaze firefighting. You may only do one mission, and it may end up being a tragedy. We met firefighters here in California where they've been really hit significantly hard, that were riding, four on engine and four on a truck, and they had what they call, a light force, where they're riding, three and three or two and three. They have five now, and both units are woefully understaffed. And then we have city managers and fire chiefs that want to explore Quince. Well, you're just putting a Band-Aid on a cut that needs stitches if you try to fool yourself into believing that you can take a four-person engine and a four-person truck company and put six people on a Quint and try to call that fire protection. You're just trying to fool yourself and the civilians that you protect. We are in very difficult times right now. We're in San Diego in talking with Chief Esther the other day. This was a department and a fire department that was experiencing brownouts for about 18 months. Thank goodness that is over. And all their units are back up, and they haven't had any layoffs, and they haven't lost any positions. But this is in a city, quite frankly, that has been studied extensively and is about 28 stations, fire stations, short of having the optimum fire protection with optimum people. And so it goes on. Advice to brothers and sisters out there that are firefighters, just understand that you cannot provide A-level fire protection with C-level staffing. You can only do so much safely. If politicians want to cut us to the bone and don't provide sufficient staffing to do A-level work and provide staffing for C-level work, then you have a family to protect as well and care for, and so you can't, based on the political climate and the way things are going, we always want to do more, but there comes to a point where we just don't have enough people, and we're going to have to provide C-level fire protection because that's what's being paid for.
Mike, there's been much talk over the last couple of years with respect to increasing the emphasis on the safety culture, and not necessarily just safety specific to apparatus, but safety with respect to the overall parameters of risk versus reward. We'll risk a lot in terms of our resources and our personnel if there's potentially a victim to be saved, and we're not going to risk a whole lot if we can determine pretty rapidly through a well-placed hand line to protect the internal means of egress and the stairs, to do a primary search to determine we got an all clear, that at least from a primary search there's no one in the building, and then beyond that we're going to risk very little. If the building is of lightweight construction, it's a commercial establishment, it's 4:00 in the morning, it was locked when we got there, we're not going to go in there, particularly if we are only minimally staffed, to try to risk to go save the building, because there's a good chance it's insured, and depending upon the amount of damage, it can be repaired, but we can't repair and or fix ourselves if we have one or two multiple fatalities in the structure because of this lightweight construction, and now we find ourselves, we've pushed ourselves to the very limit and the envelope of what we can do. It seems to me that in a lot of the locations where we've been, and you ask people, what missions do you have for the vehicle? We talk about that if you're designing a fire truck. First thing, before you worry about what color, what kind of lights, and and what are we trying to do? Define the mission of the vehicle. What do we want to do? Sometimes, Mike, I think we've missed a very rudimentary aspect of defining our mission as the fire department based upon our staffing levels to say, what are the riding assignments? If we have four people riding out on an engine or a ladder truck, there's some basic things that we can do. We've got an engineer or a chauffeur. We've got an officer that can make some initial command decisions, determine apparatus placement, make a decision as to what size hose line we're going to pull and what we're going to do. We've got a lineman or a nozzleman, and we've got a backup man. So we've got an engineer out in the street. We've established water supply, and at least we've got a reasonable team of three people going in, all right, to go place an attack on the fire. If we end up only having a three-person engine, some of those duties have to double up. They can't go away. Otherwise, if we don't establish the water supply, we're somewhat foolhardy to go in and advance an attack line to think that, well, maybe somebody else might do it, because now we're putting ourselves at risk. And if we've got staffing even lower than that, a two-person unit, at this point, we've got a big 50,000 GVW red taxi that we can disobey some V&T laws on the way there. But when we show up with that with two people, based on what needs to be done in our riding assignments, there's not a whole lot that we can do. And I think if departments really tried to break down the significant tasks that need to be accomplished on an engine or a truck, and this will play into the Quint discussion that we'll have in a few minutes, you'll pretty soonly realize, as Mike alluded to, that you just can't reduce the staffing but put them on a different kind of vehicle and think that now magically six people can do what eight people can do, because we've given them, in somebody's vision, a multi-purpose unit of a Quint, or we've combined the staffing of a two-person EMS first response unit together with an engine. We buy them a rescue engine, and now we're going to run this big unit up and down a road with four people and think that now any kind of incident that they come across, they're magically going to be able to somehow successfully accomplish without having to call for additional resources.
Yeah, it's just foolhardy to believe that, and there's been so much done as it relates to two in and two out and changing the culture and breathing apparatus and things, and then to get to this point where staffing is being reduced to just below critical levels, and we're just not able to function safely on the fire ground until we get enough resources there. And if we try to push the envelope and make that happen, the low line of duty death rate that we have enjoyed the last several years of getting below 100, and now we're in the 80s, unfortunately, and not to be a naysayer or a doomsdayer, but just very pragmatically and just knowing the business, is that could certainly be impacted and change significantly over the next few years if we're going to continue on the present course that we are. And as it relates to combining units like an engine and a truck, and we talk about it in class often, your size up starts when you get on board the fire truck. And there is a distinct difference in duties. And I come from a volunteer department as well, where we have an engine and we have a tanker tender. Well, if you ride on the tanker tender, you are going to be doing truck work. So not necessarily the idea that you need $1 million piece of apparatus that has a boom on it that swings around and goes on and on. That's not the case here at all. But the reality is that there's all fires need to have engine and truck work done, and there's a distinct separation of duties. And to take four people that are going to work on an engine and take four people that are going to work on a truck, and then to try and combine them, and of course the size ups for both units are different. Engine people are worried about stretching lines and water supply and what size line and standpipes and sprinklers and FDCs and all of that, and truck people are worried about ventilation, entry, and search. And so they're two different distinct duties. And to try and take a four-person engine and a four-person truck and then take six out of the eight and put them on a Quint and think that that's going to solve all your problems is just foolhardy at best. And what we have found, particularly if you get young firefighters that don't have a lot of experience and you put them on a Quint, and they may be second or third due and even could potentially be assigned truck duties, but if there's not the supervision in place, chances are pretty good that Quint is going to be used as an engine and that we have really wasted a lot of money and buying an aerial device that's probably not going to be used very often, and that's truly sad.
Well, Mike, specifically with respect to the Quints, both of us have seen a number of communities where they went from a more tradition-based organization with an engine and a ladder truck and then decided for a number of reasons to go into a Quint operation. The Quint requires, from my perspective, really a cultural shift and change within the department. Buying the vehicle is just a small portion of the project. For departments that feel that either from an economic standpoint because of staffing, what we've been talking about, that they're going to basically reduce the size of the fleet by one unit, typically that means we're no longer going to have a straight conventional ladder truck and equip a station potentially in a smaller area, in a smaller lighter running residential area, or buying a Quint to ensure that when that vehicle shows up it has some degree of suppression capabilities as compared to just a conventional ladder truck where we're going to have a couple of 2.5 gallon cans and that's the extent of the water suppression capabilities. It depends on the goal of what you're trying to do. But in all cases, as we've seen, buying the fire truck is just a small portion of what you need to do if the program indeed is going to be successful. It's going to involve a cultural change, retraining of the members with respect to their duties, and if you have multiple Quints coming in, of looking at the running assignments and taking the riding positions, where it means if I'm sitting in the seat behind my officer and I'm running as a ladder truck, I'm going to more than likely be part of that inside team, go in with the officer with irons and a can and a hook, and to be able to do some basic internal forcible entry and search and rescue. Subsequently, if I'm sitting behind my officer and I'm riding on an engine, more often than not, that riding position is going to dictate that I'm going to pull, stretch, and advance the hand line. I'm going to be the nozzle person, and that fourth person on the unit is going to be my backup with the officer guiding us and being observant from a safety perspective is to make sure we don't put ourselves in harm's way. If I'm riding on a Quint, we need to have an updated SOPs or SOGs based on the order of arrival and what the mission of then of the vehicle is going to be, which can change from incident to incident depending upon my order of arrival. And what we find in a lot of cases, because chiefs are under extreme financial pressure in many cases, and they're looking at, okay, say, all right, instead of buying an individual engine, Class A engine, and an individual ladder truck, I need to reduce my staffing. So for them, it's like laying down a bunt and ending up at second base, as I see it, Mike. We can lay down the bunt. I can save money from a capital expense. I'm saving money from a maintenance expense. I'm saving money from a personnel expense. And what's not to like if you're the person with the gold brass on your collar? The issue becomes when you do not adapt and change the rest of the organization and increase the amount of training and look at changing running assignments to say, that's just a small portion of the deal. When we go in to talk to departments that are now many, many years into operationally running Quints, no disrespect to the department or the unit, but it's a rare organization that we found that people say, wow, we bought Quints and we love it. If they say that, it's generally because they're within earshot of some command officer. But if you say, step out of the station, or let's go out in the back, or let's go to the rear of the bus, and they start telling you the real straight story, it's pretty heart-wrenching to hear some of the explanations that we get of people say that, you know, the chief thinks this is running great, and the expression a lot of times is, we're making it work, but it ain't working.
Well, and again, you look back at history. For two cycles of apparatus in the city of St. Louis, they were the end-all and cure-all for the Quint concept. People from that organization would actually go out on the speaking circuit and tout the advantages of this concept. They have a new chief of department now, and St. Louis, like many places who have tried the Quint concept, have come to realize, the chief of department there said that after 20 years of doing Quints, we've come to the realization that we can't function as trucks anymore. We're incapable almost of doing good truck work because we've lost our edge because of what we've done. And so the city of St. Louis, and they're among some others that are switching back and going back to a traditional engine and truck running assignment. And I think that's very telling. Hey, you tried it. You gave it a good 20-year shot. You find out that it wasn't the panacea that it was meant to be, and that you need to change, and not for the sake of change, but you need to change back because what you tried, quite frankly, wasn't going to work. And just one other comment about the apparatus as well, is that often what we find is that we'll go work with the department with specifications on a Quint, and you start asking questions like, how long does it take to get five engines into the center of this town? Oh, about 5 minutes. Then what are you doing? Why are you? And we challenged people in our class the other day and really opened up some eyes there, I think, and they were all set to come in and potentially purchase a Quint. And then we basically pleaded our case and said, you know, a lot of times we'll go to a place and say, well, how often have you used a pump on that Quint since it's been new? And yeah, it's twice, and that was for drills. And then you find out that they can get five engine companies into the center of town in about 5 minutes, and you know, say, well, what are you doing? You know, why are you putting the pump and tank on? Yet there are other cases where we go, and because of ISO requirements, they may require a fire flow of 4,500 gallons per minute, and you have two 1,500 gallon per minute pumpers, and enough base space for three apparatus, and you need to get a ladder. Obvious then that you're going to have to put a 1,500 gallon per minute pump on that to meet the ISO requirement to keep insurance rates down. And so just a lot of thought and consideration needs to be taken and put into this purchase before you go take that leap of faith. Like Brother Tom said, it's almost easy to go buy the apparatus. Now, when you get it, what kind of training are you going to do, and what kind of, basically, a cultural change are you going to undertake here in order to successfully and safely integrate this piece of equipment into your day-to-day operations?
Thanks, Mike. With that, we're going to take a quick break and be right back. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, live from San Diego at Firehouse World. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. It's Mike Wilbur, Tom Shandy, Apparatus Architects from sunny San Diego, California. We're going to finish up this month's podcast by talking about some considerations of things of how to plan and justify your apparatus replacement. Right behind fire trucks, Brother Mike and I, one of the other things that we think that are pretty cool, and you have to be in a foul weather climate to be able to appreciate these vehicles, are big snow plows. So over the course of the last couple months, when I've been out driving around, I've stopped in to talk to a few back east, at least we call them superintendents of highways, basically the gentlemen that are in charge of overseeing highway maintenance, all the different pieces of equipment that that they operate, and ask them how they plan the replacement of their heavy trucks, typically Class 7 and Class 8 commercial chassis rigs of all different descriptions that are equipped with snow plows that they use for the snow season to move snow around. And it's interesting that in the worst case scenario, I had a gentleman who was a maintenance supervisor of one of the shops for a fairly large county in upstate New York, told me that they plan their plow replacements at the 12-year mark. And I asked him what was significant about that. And he said, well, at that point, based on the engine hours that are accumulated on the unit and the mileage, and with that, we go out onto the shop floor and I hop up into the front seat of a International Paystar that was 12 going on 13 years old, and see that it's got 133,000 miles on it, and you got to be thinking about those 133,000 miles on a vehicle like that that are see a lot of heavy duty, heavy use as compared to a fire truck. I thought was pretty interesting. So I said, well, what do you or the people above you have to do to then like justify to say, okay, you know, truck number 153 is coming up on that 12-year mark. We need to go buy a new one. And he goes, well, no, that's all laid out. We said we've got everything in the fleet program based on the number of units we buy each year, and it doesn't generally come as a surprise. He said when we have to go in front of the county council and with our capital budget, he goes, other than increasing it a slight amount each year to make allocations or differences for something that we might want to do different on the vehicle, or he said obviously no different what we faced in the fire service with the engine changes that occurred in 2007 and 2010 that bumped up the cost. He said that amount of money's in there, and then we go out and we develop specifications and we bid those each year. So there wasn't, it was kind of interesting, there wasn't any particular degree of standardization in terms of the cab and chassis. I saw five or six different brands, a couple of different brands of the plow equipment themselves, because they buy these complete so they can operate. Obviously, you don't run the snow equipment on there year-round, but a little bit different than buying a fire truck that we may or may not buy it with equipment. But I thought it was rather interesting that it was pretty well thought out program, and in a couple of other smaller jurisdictions that I visited, yeah, we're talking about something that ranges between $160,000 to like $200,000 per unit. That's a lot of money, but it were things that were programmed, and he said it generally doesn't come as a surprise. He said if we have a major malfunction with having to rebuild an engine or a transmission or something like that, you know, that comes out of my maintenance budget, and we just figure it out from there. So that's kind of interesting, because sometimes in the fire service, when we don't have a plan, and then we have some type of issue or catastrophe, people want to raise, you know, throw down the yellow flag right away on the field, Mike, and like, we need to buy a new rig. We were in a community not too long ago where they had a tower that happened to be one of the older units in the fleet, but they start getting feedback from the folks saying that the unit's puffing white smoke out of the exhaust. You know, that can't be good. So it's time to buy a new ladder truck, you know. And you know, that may very well have been a symptom of a larger issue, but it's just because the unit's getting old, or we don't like it, or we don't think it fits our needs, or the guys down the road got something a little bit bigger or a little bit nicer, that we need to have a plan. And whether the size of your fleet is two pumpers and a brush truck, going up the fleets that we've reviewed that have had, you know, a couple of dozen upwards of 30 vehicles in their fleet, you need to have a plan, more so than ever. If you just can't go to your municipal body, the people that control the purse strings, and start appealing to them with the old line in some cases, well, we're volunteers and you kind of need to buy a rig for us because the rig is coming up on 18 years old. And yeah, we know the term back east is in these difficult, challenging economic times. But by the way, you know, pony up.
$1 million. Oh, go for the million, Brother Tom.
I was going to keep it at like $550,000, Mike, and just say, give me $550 for a pumper and I'll stay out of your hair for the next 36 months. We need to have a plan. So, Mike, what are some of your thoughts here? I think we should look at, when we say a fleet, sometimes people kind of poo-poo that by saying, fleet, I got four rigs. That's not a fleet. If you've got more than one, folks, you've got a fleet.
Right.
You've got a fleet of something, and it needs to be planned. And I think we have falsely fallen under the guise of, unless you happen to be a large department that almost annually or semi-annually or biannually goes out to buy fire apparatus, that when we go to appear in front of our council or the authorities that have control of the funds, they're going to see the fire department show up and just literally, you know, throw their pocketbooks or their, you know, their wallets at you. It's, hey, no problem, Chief, go buy what you need here, because we know you wouldn't be here if you didn't need it.
Yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, Brother Tom, those days are gone forever. The reality is, again, just talking about snow plows and even front-end loaders and graders and any other, pretty much any other heavy equipment with the exception of maybe cranes, the single most expensive expenditure on wheels that a municipality is going to expend money for is a piece of fire apparatus. Hands in a way. Probably the only thing in a municipality that would cost more would be to build a building or replace a fire station. And given that, the idea of, like you were saying, it's rusted, it's almost 20 years old, we'll go tell the mayor that we need a new one next year, those days, again, are gone forever as well. It's amazing in this day and age how many people, and you mentioned about fleets, if you have a fire truck, or two, you have a fleet, and that goes all the way up to 20 or 30. And you really need to, like Brother Tom said, have a plan in place as to how you're going to manage the fleet. And fleets, again, go from one or two trucks up to what we're trying to do in New York now, retrofit 559 fire trucks with new seat belts that are going to be a little bit better than what we had. And it really takes a great degree of planning and forethought to manage whether it's the smallest fleet or the largest fleet. And it really, we have found, because that's part of what we do, but whether we do it or somebody else, it is really a benefit to have an outside third party sometimes come in and look at your fleet and your operations and to determine from an educated, knowledgeable, experienced point of view as to how you need to move forward and what you may need to replace and when you may need to replace it. And we have gone to places, believe it or not, to evaluate their fleets and find out that some of the newer apparatus may need to be cycled out of the fleet first because it was potentially lightly specced out with lightweight components and basically was a unit that was specced out for a 5-year lifespan versus a 20, and that life expectancy is come and gone, and it becomes a unit now that is just eating the maintenance budget alive. And anybody that comes in and evaluates a fleet, one of the things that they're going to do is to be able to compute for you the cost of ownership, whether it be cost per run, cost per year, cost per mile in some larger fleets, particularly over-the-road truck fleets that are managed. They manage them on a cost per mile basis. With fire trucks, because we don't necessarily put that many miles on them, it becomes generally a time period of months or yearly. Well, what does this apparatus cost to run? And at some point in time, it goes past its useful life, and somebody needs to step in and say, hey, it's time to buy a new one. But again, that needs to be planned out over time, so that we're not surprising municipal officials and saying, you know, we need the Visa Gold Card, Mayor, that this year's the year, and there's been no planning financially to encumber that money and to set it aside to be able to make the purchase.
Great points, Mike, and things when you're talking about the maintenance costs. This is one area where the department really needs the hierarchy of the department. Not doesn't necessarily going to fall to the chief. Whoever is overseeing the maintenance of the apparatus needs to have a pretty good handle as to what his annual maintenance cost on each piece of apparatus are. We're somewhat amazed that when we ask departments what they have in the way of records for that, in some cases it's like, well, we'd have to pull the whole year's worth of invoices because we pay invoices here in this department on a monthly basis, and we really don't have any specific records by vehicle or maintenance logs, so we get copies of a whole bunch of stuff and we just kind of sort through things and figure it out. But you're absolutely right. There are sometimes, due to the degree of complexity of components on a unit, one that I can think of recently was a department that was very, very nice, you know, modestly run department with three stations, and their newest pumper had the highest operating maintenance cost because of a combination of it ran more calls. It had a calf system on it, and again, we're not talking poorly about calves, but that unit had some issues with the calf compressor and some other components, and the annual operating cost on that unit was more than double the cost of a unit that was 10 to 15 years its senior. So the operating cost of the apparatus are significant. Your frequency of use. It may come to the point where you're used to, in a multiple station operation, buying a new piece of apparatus and having it assigned to the station that the unit's being replaced, you may have to think about cycling rigs through and taking a newer unit that's operating well and bumping that down to a smaller, lower run department and purchasing the new rig to keep it in the station that is more active. You can also look at potentially different funding streams. While obviously the apparatus has to be paid for before we place the unit in service and is shared with the department, there are opportunities to look at either prepayment discounts if you have some monies available that are locked away in a CD. You may find themselves that you can make more money for the community by prepaying a portion of the contract, or looking at leasing as a fixed cost, which can be accrued over a period of years, that is a fixed cost that the department or the organization can budget for, so you don't need to come up with that, you know, major large amount of cash just at the point of purchase when you go to accept and take delivery of the vehicle. You may also occasionally be able to play upon the sympathies of the community and the holders of the purse strings, as you say. If there was a significant recent event where you had, hopefully not this was the case, but occasionally it happens, a failure of a piece of apparatus to function properly, a lot of times Mike and I will hear stories of folks that had particular significant with aerial apparatus to say, well, we had the testing company come in and quote, the vehicle wouldn't pass. Well, saying it wouldn't pass certification inspection, that in and of itself doesn't mean that the vehicle couldn't be fixed and to be used additionally. But if it means, for example, that you had significant weld defects on an aerial, on sections of an aerial that required a new ladder section, or the section had been bent and twisted and nobody owned up to what caused that problem, there are times where you have to say the amount of monies that you would expend to fix a vehicle could potentially overtake what the cost of the vehicle would be worth, or even if you did fix it, you wouldn't recoup that in the resale value of the unit. unit on the market. Those are all things that you need to look at when it comes time to plan. But most importantly, you need to have a demonstrated plan for when you anticipate the units are going to be replaced, so that the folks within, both internal and external to the organization, most importantly the community or the folks that are going to support the financial payments for the vehicle, are all in sync. We've done a lot of, going to a lot of departments, and we say, do you have a fleet replacement plan? Absolutely. We replace them at 20 years. So we take the little inventory rundown and put the box score up there and look at the batting order for the nine players that you have, and look and say that the average age of the unit is 17 and three quarters years, and you're still running some rigs that are 25 or 26 years old. Well, I guess you don't have a 20-year replacement plan. So it's one thing to have a replacement plan. It's another whole thing to say it is a funded replacement plan, and those are some of the things you need to consider. So that's our wrap-up for today, Mike. Any final parting thoughts here? I know sooner rather than later, we're going to either pull the plug here in San Diego, or they're going to put us in the cargo hold in a plane and send us back to the cold, snowy Northeast. Your thoughts?
Well, Brother Tom, thank God we only have a couple more months of winter to go in the Northeast. It's been wonderful here out in sunny San Diego. The brother and sister firefighters out here are tremendous. They come, they support us with open arms and welcome us and take care of us, and we really appreciate that. Special shout out to Chief Kevin Esther from the San Diego Shops, who entertained me the other day while Brother Tom was up at the Marine Air Corps base at Camp Pendleton looking at some fire apparatus up there. But we want to thank those folks for accommodating us while we're out here on the West Coast.
All right. Thanks, Mike. And you mentioned, yeah, on my one day off, I went up to Camp Pendleton to meet and work with Chief Thompson, Chief of the Camp Pendleton Marine Corps Fire and Emergency Services. And two things that are very, very humbling. One is to have the opportunity to meet the brothers and sisters up there that are protecting our soldiers and Marines, but to have the opportunity to tour around that facility and see Marines in different kinds of combat training and literally youngsters that are protecting our country brings a whole new meaning to myself of what the how great our country really is, and to our military that are constantly out there securing our safety no matter where you are in this great land. So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, live from San Diego at Firehouse World, everybody stay well, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.